ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, so obviously we are experiencing an unprecedented situation in the markets right now with the fallout from what's become a global pandemic, the coronavirus. The S&P 500 is now down about 30% in less than 4 weeks. That includes a 12% drop just yesterday alone. We're seeing these massive intraday swings across both stocks and bonds, multiple circuit breakers triggered. It's really been staggering watching how quickly things have unraveled since stocks hit a record high on February 19th, which now seems like an eternity ago. Now, if you recall on last week's show, ETF.com's Drew Voros and I, look, we took a bit of a victory lap, and we talked about how ETFs have been functioning perfectly throughout the chaos, right? Outside of a few bad prints on some ultra short-term bond funds, ETFs had passed every single test thrown their way. When you consider we had the fastest stock market correction ever, fastest bear market, record trading volumes, all sorts of volatility, and we saw zero issues with ETFs. Well, over the past week, after our little victory lap, as it turns out, ETFs have faced an even greater challenge. I would say probably their most significant test since SPY launched back in 1993. On the show this week, I have a very special guest. Quite simply, there is nobody better to discuss how ETFs have traded recently than Reggie Brown, the ETF godfather, currently principal at GTS, who's a leading electronic market maker. And look, there's been a lot of back and forth on social media, a lot of forensic work being done, all sorts of analysis on how ETFs have operated recently. And so we're going to hear from the best in the business on how ETFs have handled everything and whether there have been any major issues. So we'll start there. I'll then be joined by Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree. I want to get Jeremy's take on the financial markets and how he's sort of handicapping all of the potential fallout from the coronavirus moving forward, both shorter term and longer term. And then we'll also discuss ETF portfolio construction and highlight a few WisdomTree ETFs. And then to close this week, I'll switch gears. Hopefully we can end on a bit of a lighter note. Tim Rotolo, CEO and founder of North Shore Indices, will spotlight the index behind the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, and he'll explain the investment case for uranium. Pack show, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Okay, so now on the line with me from New York is Reggie Brown, principal at GTS. Reggie, it's an absolute pleasure. Really appreciate you taking the time during what I can only imagine has been a chaotic last few weeks for you.
Thank you. Yep, it's been very interesting. I think that this market is unprecedented in it with the number of moves that we've witnessed here. But look, ETFs are designed for exactly this environment. So it's been interesting to watch some of the empirical evidence being developed around the behavior of ETFs.
Well, I'm curious, you've been in this business for a while now. I know you've experienced a dot-com crash, certainly the global financial crisis, all sorts of other episodes we've seen in the markets, right? Flash crashes and so forth. Where would you rank what we've witnessed over the past several weeks?
Well, I think it's still developing. I would, a lot of my peers and I have a similar view that there's a lot of similarities back to the period of 08, 09, and 10. Doing, a market-wide system stress that we all live through, and it seems as though that this time is, has parallels to that.
I mentioned that stocks hit record highs on February 19th. I'm just curious, was there anything boiling under the surface prior to that? Anything that caught your attention in terms of, I don't know, ETF trading volume, flows, creations, redemptions, anything at all that seemed off to you?
I mean, leading up to our current environment, you know, ETFs, by and large, both equity ETFs and corporate bond ETFs, working extremely well, and you know, allowed investors to express their views. You know, so I think what we're seeing now is, particularly in the SPY, it becomes the hedging vehicle of choice, and you're seeing just tremendous volume and then net creations going into it. Just yesterday, I think we saw about $7 billion in new dollars going into SPDR. And so what you're seeing is that these times, folks look for instantaneous price, and ETFs provide that. And so you have two major ETFs. You have SPY, the SP 500, offered by State Street. It's the world's biggest ETF that gives investors a hedging vehicle. And you're also seeing the iBox, offered by iShares and LQD, as also a hedging vehicle for credit. And so it's just amazing to witness some of the net flows and trading volumes into both vehicles.
And Reggie, just taking a step back, can you briefly describe what GTS does for people who may be unfamiliar with the firm? How do you like to describe what GTS does?
Well, I think first, GTS is the largest New York Stock Exchange designated market maker. We run 1,100 different corporate equities on the floor to New York, about 38% of the listings, and $13.5 trillion in market cap. So with that framework, we're also ETF market makers. Historically, that's what I've done for the last 30 years. And then from the perspective of other businesses, we are retail market makers executing retail trades for the retail platforms like you know, various retail platforms like Schwab, TD, and Fidelity, et cetera.
And can you just explain high level the role of a market maker?
The market maker applies our capital, and we have a firm of obligations to be in the marketplace continuously to smooth out transactions and to help customers facilitate trades across the board. So our principal business is designated market making, corporate equities, ETFs, and then we have a brand new option business that that provides capital in the options market. It's number three in the space.
Okay, so in terms of how ETFs have functioned during this crisis, you mentioned SPY and LQD. Look, I want to offer a little bit of a context here, because on the show last week, I made the point that as ETFs have grown in popularity, we've continued to see these fear mongers, right? Often active mutual fund managers who have probably been losing business to ETFs, but they're out there pushing narratives like ETFs are going to fail or somehow make the situation worse during a market downturn. I'm sure you've heard just about every argument under the sun against ETFs. With that as a backdrop, you mentioned SPY and LQD, but overall, how have ETFs held up over the past week? And then perhaps we can get into some details.
No, I think equity ETFs, flying colors, has allowed clients to pass risk very efficiently. And I think that over the last 5 years, well, first of all, ETFs have been in the marketplace for 30 years as of March 9th, 1990, first listed in Canada. So we have 30 years of empirical evidence how ETFs behave in all types of markets. And this is just another data point here that the behavior is relatively strong. And so for equity ETFs, over the last 5 years, there's been rules and marketplace refinement how ETFs are traded, particularly equity ETFs, how they've been traded, and the rules have been refined to ensure marketplace resiliency and transparency and investor protection. So all that is there. I think what you're seeing, particularly there's a growing narrative around the corporate bond ETFs and then how they're traded, and I think that's just the underlying predictor of just what's happening in the corporate bond market and how that's currently structured. So equities flying colors, corporate bond ETFs, and the market that they follow, there's work to be done by the corporate bond market people, you know, to refine their marketplace.
So I think you raise a good point, because my sense is that most people, even some of the bigger fearmongers, I do feel like they get that stock ETFs aren't a real risk. I think most people can look at stock ETFs and they see how these can add secondary market liquidity. They do act as shock absorbers during market disruptions, which, by the way, is exactly why they were created, right, after the 1987 market crash. But when it comes to the bond side of the equation, this seems to be where there are a lot more concerns, because you hear the term liquidity mismatch, right? That ETFs are advertising intraday liquidity around illiquid assets. And so that could pose a problem. And you look over the past week, especially to your point on the corporate side, we have seen a large number of bond ETFs trading at sometimes pretty sizable discounts. So can you offer some more detail here? I mean, do you view this as a concern? You talked a little bit about bond market structure. What's going on here? I mean, is this an ETF issue or is this a bond market issue?
Well, I think there's a lot of wonky terms out there, but ETFs are only as efficient as the marketplace that they represent or have underlying assets in. And I will also contrast that there's no free lunch in life. So how ETFs behave, also mutual funds also have the same exposure. It just comes down to how they're priced, and then what the liquidity surface is inside of the underlying corporate bonds. So I'll offer a couple things just so that to keep it high level. One, the net asset value of an ETF and how it's struck, it's very similar to how a mutual fund determines its fair value. And if they both invest in the same underlying corporate bond, and the fund manager needs to trade that bond as well as ETF market maker, the outcome is very much the same, and you get the same pricing structure. What ETFs allow you to do is to get a real-time view of where corporate bonds are trading, whereas a mutual fund, you don't have that ability. So ETFs come with several benefits. One, you can sell short. Two, you can trade instantaneously. You don't need to wait until a mutual fund strike its NAV. And where the bonds are being struck is where the ETF is forecasting versus it is net asset value. So mutual funds determine their fair value overnight. ETFs determine it real time. And what you're seeing is that ETFs look like they're trading at a discount, but in reality, ETFs are priced on a bid of the bonds or a midpoint. And when the spreads widen out, and ETFs appear as though they're trading at a premium discount, it's just reflective where the bonds are really trading and where liquidity is happening real time. So the 5 and 6% discounts you're seeing in some of the corporate bond ETFs is just representative of a static NAV, but where the bonds are trading real time at that particular moment that everyone has to trade and have exposure to.
Reggie, I've seen some people out on social media argue that bond mutual funds are better for investors because you will always get execution at NAV. You don't have to worry about those discounts that you're talking about, even if those discounts represent fair value of the underlying bonds. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Well, I think you need to quantify what's NAV. If a corporate bond is trading at 85 cents on a dollar and both the mutual fund manager and the ETF community must trade at the same price, NAV is NAV where the bonds are trading real time. And so it's just a reflection of just the real time. So the argument that mutual funds have, because they're mutualized and offer a safer protection, that's a misnomer. What you're seeing is that, you have to ask an investor, where do you want to be if you're a frequent trader or you want to know how assets are being priced? Where you want to go to, ETF is the go-to source. And I'll give you also a hint. Most mutual fund managers fair value their mutual funds to ETFs. And so that's a real-time predictor that mutual fund managers use. So it really comes down to the structure of the bond market and how bonds are traded. I think that if you contrast between the equity markets and the fixed income marketplace, the fixed income market needs to bring some more innovation in the marketplace, and particularly around a national best bid, best offer where bonds are quoted real time. And then looking at how ETF mutual funds or ETF funds are fair valued, only 20% of the bond universe trades on a given day. So you have a lot of stale pricing. So I think that the evidence empirically will demonstrate that perhaps the pricing of corporate bonds need to find some innovation so that investors have a true price of where the marketplace is being priced real time.
Reggie, from the market making side, and I know this can be a little bit difficult without getting too far into the weeds to explain, but can you try to walk through at a basic level how ETFs price and why it is that they do operate as price discovery vehicles during times like this?
Absolutely. The typical ETF is benchmarked on the bid of the bonds or at the midpoint of the corporate bonds. And just like an equity ETF, it's summed up by the sum of the parts at the last sale. And so with a corporate bond ETF, if they're benchmarked to the bid of to the midpoint of the bonds and they're trading on the offer, it looks like they're trading at a premium. And if they're trading on the bid of the bonds, it looks like they're trading at a discount. And so it's just a rule structure. The way the corporate bond market operates is that you see prices offered by dealers, and then you have an independent agent that fair values every fixed income ETF. And that fair value may be based on prices that occurred days ago, because only 20% of the bonds trade on a given day. And so you have this ecosystem here around corporate bonds that is dealer dependent, and you don't have real-time look at where the entire universe is being priced given the nature of a corporate bond. And so it comes down to ETFs have some static pricing based on the nature of the market system or how corporate bonds are traded, whereas equities, you have tick by tick, moment by moment, and you have a firm obligation to stand up to where quotes are being traded. Where corporate bonds, you don't have that.
With the multiple circuit breakers that we've seen triggered, has that complicated things at all in terms of the ETF pricing?
Well, I would tell you that, one, the liquidity in the marketplace, and let's just look at the two futures, the S&P 500 future and the Treasury futures. I mean, the liquidity has thinned out tremendously, almost to 2008 levels, where the top of the book display of the depth where you can trade notionally where futures are at are tremendously thin. And so because of that, you have some liquidity issues across the board where market participants aren't displaying fully where they're willing to buy and sell, and that gives you the whipsaw in the marketplace. And so that's one of the, I think, input factors that we have to look at when markets get whippy. Liquidity goes lower. And so from the perspective of an ETF, equities are tremendously valuable. A real-time pricing agent. Fixed income, I think you need to have a little more introspection of where the bonds are trading and use ETFs as a proxy real-time. And it's hugely beneficial, particularly.
So, Reggie, I don't want to put words in your mouth. If we look over the past several weeks, is it your belief ETFs have been functioning properly, or have you seen anything broken?
I would say by and large, nothing broken. The creation redemption mechanism has worked across the board for nearly every ETF cycle. I think what needs to be looked at is going to be the fixed income marketplace and how bonds are fair valued. There's something called a security information processor, or SIP, that collects information real time and disseminates in the equity markets. You need something very similar to that in a fixed income world in order to give investors a real-time view about where corporate bonds are trading. So I think there are solutions out there. I think the fixed income marketplace needs to run a little faster around innovations and look what works well in other parts of the world. But the creation redemption mechanism across the board fundamentally is intact and works well.
And something that I want to point out from the end investor's perspective, look, you don't have to trade during a market dislocation, right? As a matter of fact, it's probably not the best time to trade. So unless you absolutely have to, you might want to think twice about selling into an environment like that. And Reggie, I guess on that note, I mean, any tips that you would offer to investors who do have to sell in this environment? I know we hear always use limit orders. Do you agree with that? Anything else that you would add?
Yeah, I think the basic thumb rules are this. Look, first of all, in this current market of competition, there's no better time for retail investors to enter the marketplace, regardless of what's happening with fundamentals. You know, you'll take your view. With free trading at the retail brokerage and fractional shares, the experience that retail investors have going through the retail platforms is extremely high. I would tell you that you know most investors should resist the urge to react to quick moves, and particularly as the marketplace is going through trading halts, where you have market-wide system halts to slow down rapid trading, particularly on the downside. You know, it's probably best to wait until the market has the most liquidity and the most information in the marketplace in order to make a trade so you get the best outcome. So, obviously, you want to use limit orders, and you want to be in control of your trade as much as possible when using various market access systems through the retail broker platforms. And if you do that, you know, the best outcome.
Well, Reggie, really appreciate your perspective on everything. Nobody knows this space better than you do. Let's definitely do this again, hopefully under better circumstances. But thank you for taking the time this week.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Reggie Brown, principal at GTS. My next guest is Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree, who currently offers nearly 80 ETFs, around $30 billion invested. Jeremy is on the line with me from New York. Jeremy, always great to connect. Thanks for taking the time.
Always a pleasure, Nate. Good to see you.
So, look, I think we obviously have to talk financial markets given everything going on right now. And quite frankly, I'm not even sure where to begin. So as of yesterday, the S&P 500 is now down about 30% from its February 19th high. We've seen the fastest correction ever, fastest bear market ever. We're seeing 9, 10% up and down moves in a single day. We saw, what, a 12% down move just yesterday. You know, to me, there's no question the sheer speed and magnitude with which all this has occurred is certainly unprecedented. Give me your take. I mean, what have you been thinking as you've watched this whole thing unfold?
Listen, it's a lot of panic in the markets, and you know, rightfully so to some regards, where there's uncertainty, people don't know how to react. Now, some of these sell-offs are what really creates the better forward-looking returns. Prices are coming down, valuations are becoming reasonable. I think people in some ways over-extrapolate the uncertainty in the markets and think this is going to continue forever. I think actually now that we're taking the quarantines and separations much more seriously, it's much more likely to, in a way, correct. We do have to take it very seriously, and we do need to separate people so that the virus doesn't spread. But once we actually admit that and start doing that, you could say, you know, maybe it's a 4-week, 8-week disruption, and it'll get better, and we'll get back to quote-unquote normal, whatever the new normal living daily lives means. But, you know, I think in the short term, people just think that, you know, they just don't know how to react. You know, I've been working with Professor Siegel from Wharton for the last 20 years. He's got a book that's a good time to remember at this kind of time, Stocks for the Long Run. Talks about all the long-term time periods, and obviously stocks look very volatile in the short run. But over long-term time periods, you know, as you get to 20-year periods or more, people saving for their retirement, it's hard to think about 20 years, you know, when you're thinking about what's been going on just the last 3 weeks. But you got to, when you step back and you are saving for long-term allocations, these are the type of things that create value. The reason why stocks have a quote-unquote risk premium and earn a better return than bonds is they do suffer through these kind of drawdowns. But now it's time to start looking at it. You look at the dislocations on where is that equity risk premium today. You know, treasury bonds with inflation-adjusted yields are negative. You know, you're going to give the money to the government. You're going to get less back 10 years out versus a broad, diversified basket, 1,400 dividend-paying stocks in the U.S., really the beta of dividends, all the dividend payers out there today. You know, yields in the dividends are 4.5 to or above, And the companies have been doing buybacks in 2% plus. So you're basically a 7% total distribution type yield. Now, we know there's risk to these dividend levels. We know buybacks are going to stop to some extent, but just saying as we get back to normal, and there's no sense in next year, a year from now, earnings cash flows won't come back to where they are today, that's a really attractive price. But you know the next 12 months is very uncertain on that perspective. That's what getting the panic. But I do think the long-term valuation levels are actually pretty attractive.
Jeremy, when you talk about getting back to normal, and look, with the caveat that none of us have a crystal ball, right?
Yeah.
None of us have ever been in a situation before where we're attempting to handicap how a global pandemic will impact the economy and financial markets. But what's sort of your base case as you look over the shorter term and then perhaps a longer term? Or what are some things you'll be watching for as the situation evolves?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear we're shutting down the economy. So for the next 8 weeks, it's going to be not a lot of activity, quote-unquote recession. You can't look at any of the earnings numbers now, but they're all going to come way down. And that's what's getting people to not know how to price and value these stocks. But I think, as we've talked about, even if you took a 20 P.E. ratio, which is where the S&P 500 was selling at the start of the year, or even a little bit before this sell-off occurred, 1 year of earnings, even if earnings went completely to zero, you would say should impact the market 5% or so. Now, I don't think earnings are actually going to zero, and I think actually, you get to 2021, 2022, earnings will rebound back to this more normal where they were, even if you just took 2019 levels. So I think that's the kind of sort of objective thinking about the markets, we're trying to look at it, that we will get back to where earnings were in 2019. It won't take that long. It will be disruptive now, but it'll come back as we get back, later in the year.
Besides hopefully seeing the coronavirus cases, ultimately peak and then roll over, is there anything that you think needs to happen in the economy? And I guess I'll frame it like this. We saw the Fed bring out their bazooka, right? It looks like they've done everything they can. Do you think we need fiscal stimulus now? Or is there anything else that you think needs to happen in order to sort of get things back on track?
Well, it's not their last shot. I know everybody looked at the Sunday move. They lowered 100 basis points. They started quantitative easing, $500 billion of Treasury bonds, $200 billion of mortgage backs to try to aid some disruptions I was having in the Treasury market, which is the most liquid market. But there's definitely more they still can do. There's different levels of funding stress, commercial paper companies rolling over short-term loans from the money market disruption. If you think about a private company who had credit facilities at a bank, you had a revolver loan that you could call. I know, a private equity firm that told all the companies they own, it started with Blackstone being the first to advise all their private companies. They all went to the banks and said, give me the revolver. It's sort of insurance. And so that's one of the things that came in the funding market. I think one of the reasons why you had disruptions in some of those markets last week is that banks had to start giving the cash all to the companies who were drawing down their credit facilities. And there's more the Fed could do to support that. During the financial crisis, they had all these, alphabet soup of facilities like TALF and TAF and all these different financing facilities that basically just puts more cash, more collateral banks can put with the Fed in exchange for short-term cash. And I think that will ease some of the stress in those markets. But that's one of the things, I think that's going to be imminent, really. The Fed is not holding back. They're going to do whatever it takes, really, to sort of ease that stress, and they're doing it quickly. So I'm not really worried about the Fed. In terms of, there's certainly people I have personal anecdotes, friends who have small businesses who had to, all of their demand vanished, all of activity stopped, and he was sad and crying and had to lay off half his people. And so that is happening, and the question is, how do you get support? And some of the new, the new programs that they're trying to do for these small businesses, how to extend unemployment, that's the kind of stuff we need to put in buffers for people who are losing their jobs. And I think we're going to do more of that, but that's obviously the number one consideration right now.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch. I know the Fed said that they wouldn't take rates negative. Do you think that's a possibility? Do you think that's still on the table, even though they said they wouldn't?
The question is, do they think it would help? If they actually thought it would help, I think they would do it. I don't think they think it would help. And I think even in Europe, they're starting to admit, is this really a good thing? In Japan, which after the Fed unleashed their bazooka, Japan unleashed more of their bazookas. And what did they do? They did not take rates more negative. They doubled their purchases of equity ETFs, actually.
Right.
So they, you know, so they're trying to support the equity markets, and actually they're buying 4%. Actually, what the Bank of Japan is doing is like a 4% buyback yield, additional cash flows taking stock out of the market. And now people say, well, what is that become a risk that the Bank of Japan is going to unload all this? It's much more likely that they hold these kind of securities more or less forever, versus then, you know, coming back onto the market. But I think there's a recognition it is hard to go more negative in Europe. Now the question is, well, whether the ECB will admit it, and can they actually raise rates? But that is one of the big questions. And I think if the Fed thought going negative would help, they would do it. But in some ways, if you think about what going negative means, it's like a tax on the banks. The banks have to keep cash at the Fed, and you know they're trying to actually stimulate for the banks. Although, you know, one of the things the ECB did was they have this new dual-tiered system. It's called TLTROs, TLTROs, where they're actually giving a subsidy to the banks. Given how negative rates have hurt the banks, they're now providing financing loans at different rates, which is, you know, I think some recognition of the negative rates hurting them, but also, you know, one of the things that we could do is we could do more of those kind of things, sort of these dual-tiered rates where you say, you know, because we talk about lowering rates, penalizing savers, you know, can you provide loans to banks at a different rate than, you know, they might be able to provide to their savers is one of the interesting questions. New experimental monetary policy that's coming out of Europe.
Well, it's just amazing. You think back a year and a half ago or so, and the concern was rising rates. Right.
Yep.
And here we are talking about potential negative rates. All right. Let's move on. I do want to ask you about a few WisdomTree ETFs. And I thought we might start with China, actually. WisdomTree offers a handful of China focused ETFs, including the WisdomTree China X State Owned Enterprises Fund, ticker symbol CXSE. And this one stood out to me because you look at performance. China has actually held up pretty well, relatively speaking, which I think may surprise some people given the coronavirus, as far as we know, originated there. So, you know, you look year to date, S&P's down, what, 25%. CXSE is only down, I think, about 15%. Why is that? And I guess you want to tell us a little bit about CXSE.
That's a fantastic observation. And I think, when I look at what's going on in the markets and even trying to say, like, what is the playbook for how it's going to play out in the U.S., you know, China gives you some sense, given the virus started there and then spread throughout the world, and then look at what's happening in their markets. You know, the A-shares market was up 8% in February. I'm showing you that it basically sort of shrugged off. You know, they clamped down, they shut all activity, and it somewhat worked. I mean, they're trying to restart their economy, and I think when you look at what the government is saying for GDP growth targets, and a lot of people don't trust the Chinese data, but you know, they obviously was going to be a shutdown of activity, very low growth or negative growth in Q1. They're saying we're still going to keep our 6.4% targets for the full year. And so that means they're going to have massive, massive stimulus and interventions throughout the rest of the year. And they're going to try to make the second and third and fourth quarters way above average to get the same full year target. And that's going to reverberate throughout the global economy, I think. But that's just sort of an example of there is massive, how do we make up for this loss in demand? How do we get support? And you say stimulus, it's how do we get relief for the global economy? But I think you're going to get, in a way, overreactions from people to then reignite the economies. So China is, I think, one of those forward-looking, hopeful points. As long as we take it seriously enough to quarantine and keep people not interacting, you know, you shut down, it'll get better. And China shows you that. Now, I think one of the things about CXSE, the screens, when you screen out the state-owned companies, what are those companies? It's banks and energy. You think about what has been the worst performers everywhere around the world, it's banks and energy. Now, you say, well, what does that tilt you to? It tilts you to the China tech and China consumer in a very broad, diversified way. And, you know, you think about this work from home, as everybody's going to see, what does it do? It's, you know, you're getting support for all the online type resources. The sort of fresh food and delivery was up 170% in China. Deliveries for grocery stores, supermarkets was up 117%. Online healthcare was up 340%. And you could see that in your own activities, I'm sure. All the teleconferencing and all the internet type activities. are, in a way, being encouraged. It's one of the reasons why tech has continued to be strong relative to everywhere else. And so you can think of this as a China growth-oriented play, and it's also in the same for the broad EM markets. We have the same strategy for broader emerging markets, XSOE, which has the same, basically, strategy for China, but getting you a sort of country-neutral approach to owning EM. You know, we've been overweight emerging markets in a lot of our model portfolios, and I think as a sort of 10-year look of how would you want to allocate to the sort of overall growth profile, that is, I think, one of my preferred ways to do it, getting you this sort of tech and consumer-tilted EM versus just the broader banks, energy, state-owned type companies.
And so does the coronavirus situation change at all how you view valuations, whether in China or broader EM?
Well, I mean, all valuations have improved. All the markets have come down. So you could say, if you thought the markets were okay, decently attractive to start the year, and I'd say our broad case was on a stocks versus bonds, stocks are better 5 to 10 years out. I don't think that really changes. I mean, obviously, this year is looking bad.
Mm-hmm.
But are you going to be better off by the end of 2030 from the beginning of 2020, even factoring this decline? I'd say call me back up at 2030. I think you will be. 2025 is a tougher call, but I'd say yes, you're still going to be better off have owning stocks from the beginning of the year through the end of 2025 than you would have been in bonds. And so we still like that stocks versus bond story now, and we like EM within the broader global allocations. But now when it comes to U.S. stocks, I mean, I think the valuations on broad dividend-paying part of the market, whether it's a quality part of the market, the high dividend part of the market, you're pricing in at 7% type total distribution yields, 7% equity premium. And I know these dividends are vulnerable. We know they're going to come down. We're going to be doing all sorts of monitoring on that over the year. But I think things will normalize within 2 to 3 years there. I think we'll be back to new highs on dividends pretty quickly, even after they cut this year. And so I think that's a really attractive time to be entering the market.
All right. Another ETF that caught my attention is the WisdomTree 9060 U.S. Balance Fund, ticker symbol NTSX. So this is outperforming the S&P 500 by about 5% year to date, which makes sense because it has fixed income exposure. So this is essentially a 60-40 portfolio that's leveraged 150%. Do you want to explain this ETF and why it might be something investors should take a look at in this environment?
Yeah, there's really two ways to think of 9060. We call it the 9060 U.S. Balance Fund. And so, just to give a little bit more detail, you got exactly right. It does have some fixed income exposure on it. What it does is for every $100 that comes in the fund, it gets $90 of equities and $60 of bond futures. And so you can say, well, what does this really replace for me in my portfolio? If you thought about it as just equities, to your point on it's done, 500 to 600 basis points better than the S&P this year. And since it launched, on a cumulative basis, it's been like 900 basis points. It only launched in August of 2018. So the S&P was negative, and it was slightly, it was up 8 or 9% when I was looking at it earlier this week. It's interesting. I mean, for sure, the bonds have acted as a hedge, so as rates have fallen, as equities have fallen, bonds have gone up. And so you've got this hedge of the bond futures offsetting some of the declines in equities. And you're also going from $100 in equities of a traditional S&P 500 exposure to $90. So you're sort of de-risking your equities by 10% as it is to get that collateral. The $10 of collateral then helps fund those bond futures, and it sort of rebalances on a quarterly basis when it rolls the Treasury futures. I think the case is it could, in one way, you could say it's a way to add more bonds to your portfolio, and so you could say is a way to just get more overall diversification if bonds are acting as this hedge. Professor Siegel has talked about one of the reasons why bond yields are so low is increasingly being used as the quote-unquote default hedge asset. Instead of paying a premium to buy VIX futures or puts or whatever, the fact that bonds are the ultimate hedge asset is pressuring yields lower. And so, in a way, this combines that for people. And now you can say, well, are they still going to be the hedge asset with rates where they are? And that's a sort of reasonable question with rates sub 1% on the 10-year. But, you know, rates have gone negative in Europe, and so you could still get down lower. It's hard to know, but certainly it was, you know, quite attractive when rates were much higher. And I think it's you know, one of the use cases is just a way to get more diversifiers in your portfolio. If you think about funding this with using this instead of some of your traditional stocks and bonds, and then adding in sort of managed futures or other alternative strategies that might be a good diversifier to the traditional equity and bond stock.
And Jeremy, just to clarify to your point on rates, you know, look, we have seen unbelievable moves here recently, right? The 10-year Treasury yield is now at, what, 75 bips, 30 years at, I believe, 1.3%. That's clearly been a huge tailwind, but this can work in reverse. And to me, the biggest risk with this ETF is that rates do spike, and then you have both stocks and bonds potentially going down together, and the leverage would amplify those moves. So how should investors think about that potential risk if they are considering this ETF?
For sure, you hit on when will it underperform the S&P? If rates moved up significantly, if the 10-year went from 70 to 270, such that the bonds went, you know, that the losses on the bond portfolio more than made up for the fact that you're actually taking 10% out of equities. And so it's not guaranteed that rates go up, so you lose on the bonds, that it's actually worse than the S&P 500, because it's going to depend how much do equities move and how much do bonds move. Now, if you know, the way things are reacting now, if bond rates moved up, I would think it's a better, you know, it's sort of that risk premium's coming out of the market and stocks are doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not guaranteed for that reaction, and you could say we have massive deficit spending and rates go up dramatically and it's a bear market, and that is the worst case. And then it's just really a question of, do you lose more on the bond futures from rates going up than you have a cushion because you went from $100 in equities to $90 in equities? And you know, I think my past experience would say the cushioning would be, you know, would help you not really lose more than the S&P, but you know, the rates can move quickly and markets can move quickly. And you'll have to see which one is faster on that, which one has a higher, you know, higher impact.
Jeremy, just a couple minutes left. One other area of ETFs I did want to be sure to touch on is dividend-focused ETFs. And you were talking dividends earlier, and obviously we're talking about interest rates being so low, you know, right now. So for investors who depend on income, look, they're clearly in a tough spot. Right. And they have been for a while, but it looks even more challenging as we sit here today. And I know you recently wrote a piece on dividend yields and a dividend weighted approach as a potential alternative here. Do you just want to talk a little bit about that and maybe highlight an ETF or two?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have a broad family of dividend weighted funds for the U.S. from a total all dividend paying. I talked about the 1400 stocks in the broad total index. And then we go from large caps to small caps, quality, growth-oriented strategies, and high-dividend strategies. So it's really, you know, in some ways too much choice, depending on if you want high dividends, quality dividends, size cuts. Just on the dislocations that you're seeing, the yields on some of the small caps are in the 6.5% to 7% range, which, again, is forecasting a lot of dividend cuts. And so that'll be interesting to monitor and see how do those companies perform. It's sort of, you know, sort of that small-cap value trade has been, you know, the most painful part of the markets this year. That's what's really gotten hit. But, you know, in the broad total market, you know, the dividends on the S&P, if you go back 62 years, dividends only fell 6 of the 62 years. Only in 09 did they fall 20%, and that was all financials, which caused the cut. The dividend stream today is so much more diversified. There's no sector more than 20% of that total dividend stream today. Financials are only 16%. You get tech, healthcare, consumer staples as the next three largest, which I think are going to be immune from cuts this year. I think they'll see growth this year. You're already up a few percent of growth to start the year. That provides a little cushion. So I think, you know, I don't think dividends will fall 20%. Obviously, they could, but, you know, and, you know, it took 4 years to get back to all-time highs after the financial crisis. So I think, you know, if I'm just saying own the broadest diversified basket, DTD is our total dividend fund. And represents that, you know, total universe, you know, and that average yield has shot up above 4%, and then they're also doing buybacks. So I think that is one of the generally more attractive parts. I'd say if you're trying to get a more growth-oriented part, you know, that quality dividend growth is DGRW. You're going to get lower current yields, but likely better profitability, less levered companies. So if you're worried about the debt becoming a problem, the financials becoming a problem, energy being a problem, it's going to be in some more defensive sectors from that perspective, and that'll be more of a growth-oriented part of the dividend universe, and that's DGRW.
Well, Jeremy, always appreciate the time, certainly your perspective. Stay safe out there, and I'm sure we'll chat again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree.
Stop.
All right, my last guest this week, certainly not least, is Tim Rotolo, CEO and founder of North Shore Indices. They're behind the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker symbol URNM. This just launched back in December, and Tim is now on the line with me from New York. Tim, great to connect. A pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nate. I really appreciate it. Interesting times to be having a discussion.
No doubt. So I guess before we get into the index and the ETF, any thoughts on the current market environment?
It's tough, but it's really opening up just a tremendous number of opportunities. I mean, you know, in for the uranium mining, I'll stick to that just because that's kind of an area that I've spent more time on more recently. I mean, it's truly, you know, babies being thrown out with the bathwater. And we can talk about some of these companies, but, you know, just the simplest ones to look at are the ones that hold physical uranium. And, you know, there you can actually calculate a net asset value on a daily basis, and they're trading at 25% to 30% discounts, and physical uranium really hasn't moved during this time period. And actually, we think fundamentals continue to improve. So you actually saw in the last day two pretty big events on the demand side. There was two reactors that were supposed to be shut down. Those basically have been said that they are not going to shut down now. So demand that we thought was going to come out of the market is going to stay there for another, you know, 10 plus years or so. And then Kazatomprom, which is the biggest position in the index and also the biggest miner in the world, said they may have to shut their mines because of coronavirus. And, you know, that could be just incredibly meaningful to the market, which is, in our opinion, already in a supply deficit. So, you know, it's one of these things where you have to be prepared and really understand the value of what you're buying. And if you have, you know, those two attributes, this is maybe one of the best investment opportunities we've seen in, you know, at least the last 5 years.
Tim, to take a step back here, I know I'm no uranium expert. Do you want to maybe explain what uranium is and what it's used for?
Sure. So it's a metal, and the primary use is both civilian nuclear and then weapons grade nuclear power. Nuclear weapons. So the vast majority of it is being used. It's called low-enriched uranium, which is used to power the 400-plus nuclear reactors in the world. That generates about 11% of global electricity. And, you know, what most people, I think, in the United States don't appreciate is that 20% of our power comes from nuclear energy. So it's a really important element. And it's pretty abundant, but there's a few pockets of large deposits. So one is in the Athabasca, which is in Canada. They have very high-grade uranium. So that just means, you know, the percentage of the rock that the uranium represents, it can be between 2 and 20% in some cases. The rest of the world is like 0.02. And they actually use more of a hard rock mining method. So kind of more traditional, you would think open pit mining. Whereas in other parts of the world, like Kazakhstan, which is another area where there's a lot of uranium, they use what's called in situ leaching. And so that's more of like a kind of traditional oil and gas process. And the problem with that is that it has the same attributes of oil and gas, which is that there's significant decline curves, so you have to continue to reinvest in the wellhead. Our focus is entirely on the civilian nuclear side and the dynamics which are beginning to develop primarily on the supply side. But, you know, the demand side, we think, is just incredibly robust. And we think, you know, one of the big reasons that we thought that this is an interesting product, besides the fact that the miners are down, 80 to 90%, physical uranium's down 80+% from the highs, is that on the demand side, there's been really a lot of growth. A lot of it's coming out of the emerging markets in China, but we think that it's because nuclear is what's called base load as opposed to wind and solar, which are intermittent. In order to address the climate goals of the globe, you really do need to think about adding more and more nuclear to the grid. And so that's sustained the demand side a lot. And actually the group that we kind of focus on, which is the World Nuclear Association, has come out and said that global demand is growing about 2% per year, which if you just looked at the headlines, you would think that it had fallen off a cliff. But demand is actually the strongest it's been in several decades. And, in the United States, which we think is an important bellwether, you see these extensions on many of the nuclear power plants. So I think Duke and Exelon have both put in for 20-plus year extensions. So a lot of these reactors we thought were going to come off the grid are now going to be there for another 20 years. And you've seen in other places like France and South Korea that attempts to basically denuclearize have been basically shot down by the electorate. And then I think, kind of the most interesting case study is Germany, where post-Fukushima they essentially tried to denuclearize entirely and go 100% renewables, and it's just been an abject failure. Their electricity prices are higher, and they actually have not made any progress on their emissions goals. So, we think the body of evidence suggests that, demand should continue to be strong, and then the investment opportunity we think is on the supply side. We just think that the market doesn't understand there's not enough uranium in the market to meet those demand needs.
So, Tim, in terms of the index and the ETF itself, the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, how exactly is this constructed?
Sure. So, effectively, we bucket it with two large segments. So, let's call Bucket A and Bucket A, Bucket B. Bucket A is physical holders of uranium. So there's two listed companies out there. One is called Uranium Participation Corp. The other one is called Yellowcake. And they actually go out and they buy physical uranium and then they store it. So those are the ones that I was talking about, which are trading at these big discounts to kind of the very knowable NAV. So that's 17.5% of the portfolio. The idea there is just, to kind of lower the volatility of the portfolio because those are just not going to have the same operating leverage that the companies will. And then you have the other segment of the portfolio, which is 82.5%, and that's focused on miners. And, we think that the real opportunity in this market is the mining companies because of their operating leverage. And so we've tried to tilt the portfolio towards the junior miners. So we have a 15% cap on position sizes. The two biggest miners in the world, Kazatomprom, and it is market cap weighted. Within those two buckets. So Kazatomprom and Cameco are the two biggest positions just because their market cap is the most significant. And then below that, you have just a variety of, what we think are very interesting junior mining companies. And many of those, another really unique characteristic of the uranium mining sector as opposed to junior gold miners, silver miners, most of these are not exploration companies. All of the exploration companies have basically gone out of business. And so what you have is companies that we call near-term producers or developers who actually they've already identified a significant amount of uranium in the ground, and they're basically just waiting for prices to rise to put that into production or to start building a mine because they really need the higher prices in order to be able to finance that mine. So there's about 26 positions in the fund. Kazatomprom and Cameco are both 15%. Today. And so the only other caveat I would make is that there's a couple of non-pure play miners, which we unfortunately had to add they do have tangential exposure to uranium, but they're not the pure plays like a NextGen or a Denison Mines or a Cameco or Kazatomprom. And those represent about 9% of the portfolio today.
Tim, as I'm sure you're aware, there is another uranium ETF on the market. There's also one that covers both uranium and nuclear energy. what are some of the key differences between URNM and those two ETFs?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting story. So the genesis of this index and the ETF was that the URA, which is a Global X fund, decided in 2018 to reconstitute their index. And we don't exactly know what the rationale was, but basically they decided to kind of do the opposite of what we did and get rid of a lot of the junior miners and move towards more nuclear power construction companies and some Japanese conglomerates. Presumably that was due to liquidity, and they become a very large holder of a number of the positions. So today they only have about 50-ish percent of the portfolio in true uranium companies, and the lion's share of that exposure is to the kind of mega cap companies within the sector, Kazatomprom and Cameco. And so, you know, our view is that they're not going to have that same upside correlation to, you know, the move that we think has to come in uranium. I don't know the other product is from Van Eck, which is called NLR. I'm not as familiar with that, but my understanding is it's much more heavily weighted towards nuclear utilities and really has much less exposure to pure play uranium mining companies. So our objective was to provide a real, as near pure play option to investors as possible, because it's a very complicated, opaque sector. We've found that management teams, you know, as in many mining sectors, are not always honest. And so we do think playing it in a diversified manner is the way to go. And accumulating these stocks is, you know, it's a time-consuming process. And then also just stock picking in the sector, we think, we ultimately think that this is a long-term directional play on the price of uranium. So if you're going to play it, you know, having a diversified portfolio, we think you can do very well. You don't need to try and knock it out of the park by buying, you know, individual stocks. And, you know, so that takes me to kind of like, what is the ultimate thesis here? I did say, you know, demand is growing. Supply, we think, is actually in a deficit. But really, this comes down to economics 101. There's a supply-demand imbalance. There's not enough supply to meet future demand, and so prices have to rise. So the marginal cost of production for these miners is in probably the $45 to $50 range. The spot price of uranium today, and then I'll walk through kind of one nuance is why we don't always think spot is the most relevant price, is about $24 right now. So prices need to double. The price of uranium needs to double in order to incent mines that have come out of production to go back online. But it probably needs to go up more like 2.5 to 3x in order to incent the financing of brand new mines, which don't exist today. And we think that's the opportunity. And we think the market is just entirely missing that simple math equation. And so that, you know, if that happens, you know, these junior mining companies and even Cameco and Kazatomprom and Uranium Participation Corp and Yellowcake, we just think are, you know, very asymmetric investments. You know, a lot of upside, fairly limited downside at this point. So that's kind of the crux of the investment thesis.
Tim, to your last point, do uranium miners typically react to uranium price moves similar to how gold miners react to the price of gold? Were there essentially a levered play on the price of the underlying?
Very much so. Yeah. I do think that there might be a lag this time around, but I mean, you can go back and look at 2017 and late 2016 and what even just the URA did in that time frame. You know, it reacted very strongly to the move in uranium. So uranium really, in our opinion, bottomed in 2016. It got to about $17 and then kind of snapped back to like the high mid to high 20s, and has basically been up. It's up about 40% from that point. It's made a run at $30 a couple of times, but like we said, you know, we ultimately need to see, you know, dramatically higher prices to incent new production. Now, there's one other part of the thesis that I think, well, I mean, the thesis is incredibly complicated. It's the reality, but there's another kind of interesting nuance about the uranium industry, which is very uncommon for commodities, which is that there's not a strong, there's not a robust spot market. So unlike oil and gas, where, you know, you can just go buy on a day-to-day basis and there's a pretty good sense of what the price is, most of uranium mining, nuclear power and utilities buy 10-year contracts with the miners. And so because of that, it's actually the long-term contract price, which is the more relevant price, and that's about $32. But because of that, it's effectively allowed these companies to hedge. And so even in 2015, so post-Fukushima in 2011, which took about 13% of global electricity supply out of the market, or nuclear power supply out of the market from Japan, the miners still had contracts that they had signed with utilities in 2008, 2009, 2010, when prices were in the $70 to $80 range. So they're still living off of those in 2017, 2018, 2019. And in certain cases, they're actually still mining and they're still producing, even though the price of uranium is falling off a cliff. And so it took till 2016, 2017 for those miners to kind of have this come to Jesus moment where they said, oh, wow, you know, these prices are not going to snap back. We actually need to cut production. And so about 20% of global production came out of the market. And basically what's been happening for the last 2 years is that the market's been trying to rebalance itself. And unfortunately, there was a petition put in front of the Department of Commerce called the Section 232 petition, which was brought by two U.S. miners on the basis of national security. It's kind of like a sidebar. So the United States uses about 50 million pounds of uranium a year. We only produce about 2% of that at this point. So we import the lion's share, 99% of our uranium. And about 60% of that comes from kind of non-friendly Russian-influenced countries. And so these two uranium miners basically came to the government and said, this is a national security issue. We'd like you to force the utilities in the United States to buy 25% of their uranium from U.S. miners. That has basically set off this huge policy overhang, which lasted at first what we thought was going to be a year, but then has kind of dragged on. So Trump said no to the quotas that they were requesting, but he said, we actually think that this requires a more comprehensive study, and created what's called the Nuclear Fuel Working Group. And the Nuclear Fuel Working Group was supposed to report in November, and then we had turnover with the Department of Energy, and we had a new secretary brought in who's incredibly pro-nuclear, so that's great. But now we're just kind of waiting for the report. And everything that we hear is that the report is done, and they're actually put in the budget, the energy budget, $150 million stockpile for uranium, which is great. $150 million a year. But there should be some other bells and whistles in there that we think could be very positive. But so basically that's put the nuclear utilities on hold from entering into new contracts. And we think that's the ultimate catalyst for this sector, is that when these nuclear utilities, number one, I don't think the nuclear utilities have an appreciation for how undersupplied the market is and how low inventories are. But when they become aware of that, we think they're going to be willing to sign dramatically higher priced contracts. And at the same time, Kazatomprom, who used to be a very aggressive seller in the spot market because they were the lowest cost producer in the world, has now come out just in the last few weeks and said, we're not selling into the spot market at all. And we're basically going to wait to sign much higher priced long-term contracts. So all the dynamics point to, you know, higher prices, and now it's just kind of a waiting game. But we think this sell-off has just created, I mean, tremendous value for you know, people who have cash.
Well, Tim, it's a fascinating space. Quite frankly, it's one I haven't spent a whole lot of time tracking, so I'll certainly be interested watching this moving forward. But congratulations on the ETF. Best of luck to you, and let's stay in touch. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Tim Rotolo, CEO and founder of North Shore Indices. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, stay tuned. I'm putting together a special podcast focused on the coronavirus situation, including talking ETF and market impact, as well as just looking at the bigger picture here. So be on the lookout for that. Until then, have a great week, everyone.